Call the Subcommittee of Employee Relations to order on this beautiful day. It's too bad we can't hold it outside. Anybody willing to approve the minutes? Thank you, Senator Eaton's moved the minutes. Anybody else had a? All good? Those in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes approved. Let's hop right in. Mr. Carlson, are you want to come forward here? Go ahead and present the contracts on your morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Senators, Representatives. My name is Mark Carlson. I am the Vice Chancellor of Human Resources for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. With me here at the table today is Mr. Chris Dale, Senior System Director for Labor Relations. We're here today to provide the subcommittee with an overview of the tentative agreement reached between the Minsky Board of Trustees and the Inter-Faculty Organization, or the IFO. Mr. Dale was the employer's chief spokesperson during negotiations with the IFO. Additionally, we are presenting the subcommittee with the 2013-15 Minsky Personnel Plan for Administrators, which is a compensation plan authorized under Minnesota Statute 43.18. Let's begin with the 2013-15 tentative agreement with the IFO. The IFO represents the traditional teaching faculty at our state universities, including coaches, librarians, and certain counselors. As of fiscal year 2013, the base year for comparison purposes, there are approximately 3,527 employees in the bargaining unit represented by the IFO. Approximately one-third of those employees were adjunct or community faculty. The bargaining parties reached a tentative agreement on July 29th of 2014 after receiving verification that the tentative agreement had been ratified by a vote of the membership of the IFO. The Minsky Board of Trustees approved the tentative agreement at its scheduled meeting on Tuesday, September 16th of this year. As indicated on the settlement cost sheet distributed by Mr. Hubinger's summary, the overall cost of the IFO settlement to the employer is comparable to the agreements reached between MMB and the state's classified units and is in line with the settlements reached between the Minsky Board and the MSCF and MUSAF agreements, both of which were recently approved by this committee. At this point, I'll ask Mr. Dale to review the major economic and language features of the IFO tentative agreement. Mr. Dale.
Mr. Dale, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Chris Dale. I'll review the economics and then the language of the tentative agreement with the IFO. In fiscal year 2014, that begins July 1, 2013, the tentative agreement provides for a 3.2% salary schedule enhancement or increase. An adjunct and community faculty move a corresponding amount from $1,258 per credit to $1,298 as a minimum. The health and dental insurance benefits are the same as those negotiated by MMB with the classified units. In fiscal year 2015, the tentative agreement provides for a one-step increase for returning faculty members and a 1.45% salary schedule increase for the entire unit who is on the schedule. The adjunct and community faculty move again a corresponding amount from the $1,298 per credit as a minimum set in fiscal year 2014 to $1,349 per credit as a minimum in fiscal year 2015. Again, the health and dental insurance benefits are as negotiated by MMB with the classified units. In fiscal year 2015, we are adding three steps to the top of the salary schedule. Here are the key language changes that we negotiated in this agreement. Beginning with the 2015-2016 academic year, first-year probationary faculty members will be granted a three-credit reassignment to pursue non-teaching activities that are consistent with the faculty member's professional development plan in the professional development and evaluation process. The contract beginning in fiscal year 2015 will provide for a paid parental leave of 30 consecutive days that can be taken upon the birth of a child or the placement of an adoptive child. The contract provides for a guaranteed faculty appointment for certain academic administrators in the event that may be granted at the time of hire or any time thereafter. The contract includes substantial revisions and clarifications to the retrenchment article, that's the layoff article, and that should provide additional clarification for all those who are affected by the article's provisions. Additionally, the parties agreed that those changes would be applied retroactively and would affect any pending dispute between the parties. And finally, the parties agreed to a salary supplement for our coaches to compensate for activities that exceed the expected workload for a 9-month appointment or an academic year appointment, and or to permit the university to match market salaries for certain coaches, in particularly those coaches in the Division I programs that we have. That covers the key language items, and if there are questions, I'd be happy to try to answer.
Mr. Deal, can you tell me a little bit more about the parental leave? Is that similar to what St. Paul's doing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not completely versed in what St. Paul is doing, but I think it is similar. We have looked at a fair number of other higher education institutions before we actually entertained the proposal from the IFO, and it was subject to fairly intense negotiations between the parties. I would say that from my review of other higher education institutions that offer this benefit, we are kind of in the middle of the road in terms of the extent of the benefit and the, if you will, the value of the benefit to the employee. There were certain concerns that the employer had, and we've attempted to address those concerns by providing for an advance notice in most circumstances, and requiring that the leave be taken in 30 consecutive days and run concurrent with any form of unpaid leave that might be available to the faculty member.
Any questions for Mr. Dale or Mr. Carlson? Representative Ryan Winkler. Ryan Winkler.
Thanks, Representative
Mr. Winkler.
Representative Leon. Mr. Dale, this is a follow-up to Representative Lilly's question. So you said that the leave runs concurrently with any other unpaid leave. So it sounds to me that, I mean, as I hear that, you're limiting the benefits. So if somebody is entitled to unpaid leave, they can't extend during the period of they can't extend beyond that period. So we're talking FMLA probably, right? So an employee has FMLA, and you're giving them 30 days paid leave. The 30 days has to be taken within the FMLA period. Is that correct? Is that what you're trying to say there?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, that is correct. The paid leave does not serve to extend the FMLA leave. However, the contract does provide more extensive unpaid leave provisions for faculty members who have children.
Representative Winkler.
Representative Lilly. Mr. Dale, so do you have a disability policy? I ask because when my wife had three kids while she was working, her law firm gave her, she was very generous, 6 weeks of paid leave, and they gave her six, and then she qualified for a disability policy for another 6 weeks, which basically meant for 12 weeks she was at full salary. Do your employees have the option of additional disability time related to, especially, I guess, women giving birth?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, the state does offer, the state negotiates a long-term disability policy, but I don't believe that it necessarily covers pregnancy situations, but I'm not fully versed in the parameters of the long-term policy. There is a short-term policy that employees may purchase as well, is my understanding. The 30 consecutive days of paid leave is effectively 6 weeks of paid leave under the terms of the IFO agreement. And, of course, if there is disability that accompanies the pregnancy, then the faculty member would be able to, for the women faculty members who have children, they have continued or prolonged periods of disability, then they would be have sick leave available to them as well.
Representative, just final point. So, but the paid sick leave or the disability time would not be counted against their 30 days.
Mr. Hale, leave?
If
And to be clear, I'm looking for the most generous possible benefit here because I think we are way in the wrong direction on those issues.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, the paid sick leave would be available in addition to the paid parental leave if the period of disability continued beyond the paid parental leave. Or, if I might add, if the disability occurred before the birth of the child.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Leon Lilly. I do have, we're going to be casual. I do have a few questions. I'm going to probably have to take my glasses on and off since I'm adjusting to my new vision issues. I'd like to, I guess, kind of go through, Mr. Hebringer always does such a nice job of putting this together in a really clear manner. And you touched on some of the questions. I'm just wondering if we can go through, I see that there's, again, of course, a generous salary increase, but I would like to go through the provisions with one of the two of you. If you could talk a little bit, maybe starting on provision four. I see that the athletic coaches, and it says currently coaches are appointed on either probationary status or to a four-year term, and this allows for up to 10 years in addition to a probationary period. And then I think there's a little bit more detail on the second page, and it talks about the salaries can be renegotiated at any time. And I'm just wondering what's the purpose of this. In the past, we've seen some coaches have bad years, and then they wind up with golden parachutes, and it just seems like 10 years is an awful long time for a coaching contract because it just seems like it doesn't always work out well. So if you could just comment on why up to 10 years, and then as far as being renegotiated, could you renegotiate down, or is it just renegotiating up if they're having a good season? If they're having a bad season, can you cut them?
Mr. Dale?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the purpose was to provide additional flexibility for the state university so that they might be able to recruit and retain the best coaches that they were able to do so. I think for purposes of understanding the way coaching appointments work, it's important to bear in mind that although it is possible under the terms of the agreement to provide a probationary appointment, in practice that just doesn't happen anymore. So coaches don't follow the probationary track to tenure status any longer. That's an artifact. It remains a current provision. It's a kind of a historical practice that is no longer followed. The ability to renegotiate with the coaches allows the state universities to, in those cases where coaches are receiving competing offers or considering going to a different institution, to retain those coaches. As a practical matter, would it be possible to renegotiate down? I believe that it would be because, of course, if a coaching appointment is coming to an end and the coach wants to continue to work and the university isn't prepared to pay more, they could, in theory, renegotiate down. As a practical matter, that I'm not aware of that having happened because generally salaries don't get renegotiated down.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Dale, appreciate that. Unfortunately, I think it's unfortunate that it can usually only be negotiated one way, even if the performance isn't there. On the next, all still in Section 4, can you talk a little bit more about that that supplement not to exceed $85,000, that exceed the expected workload for a regular academic year? What would be an example of exceeding the expected workload? I guess I don't know what that means.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. Well, coaches, I think that people tend to think of coaches as having fairly cush jobs, but these are actually fairly intensely hardworking individuals who, although they are hired often ostensibly for a nine-month period, work year-round. For example, typically recruitment does not take place during the athletic season, but takes place often during off-season times when the coaches might not otherwise have technically been on contracts. So part of the purpose of the salary supplement was to start to cover the range of activities, and there are very many different types of activities that coaches engage in: camps, recruitment, conferences. So the idea was to try to encompass this whole array of activities that coaches engage in that might not necessarily fall within their normal appointment year, and to provide a way of compensating them for doing that, and also to end any debates about whether the coaches had been adequately compensated for all that range of activities, because that was becoming an area of issue for the parties, was that range of activities that had traditionally coaches had simply done without seeking additional compensation, and there was no easy way to succinctly cover all those variety of activities.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Lilly and Mr. Dale. It talks about matching the market salary. So then is $85,000, is that the market salary? And then as another follow-up, how many coaches does this affect? I'm trying to get an idea of how much this could potentially add to the cost. Does it include assistant coaches? Is it the head coach? Is there how many throughout the system could that potentially include?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I don't know the exact number of coaches in the system, so I can't give you a precise figure on that. We could look into that and provide additional detail for you if you'd want. With respect to your question about the market salaries, the $85,000 is barely adequate for some of our coaches, and it will be more than adequate for others. The reality is I don't expect this actually to drive up costs significantly or at all, because what we were finding ourselves doing was paying coaches through other compensation devices in the agreement, using duty days or extended appointments, additional credits, to pay these coaches to engage in the range of activities that we can now largely cover with a salary supplement for those off-season activities. The particular coaches who are driving the amount, the $85,000 supplement, were our Division I coaches whose salary is simply, the salary schedule is simply nowhere near adequate to attract Division I coaches. And while some folks question the appropriateness of paying coaches those sort of salaries, the fact remains if you want to have a competitive Division I hockey team with a competitive Division I, you have to have a competitive coach. And those types of coaches command salaries that exceed the top of our salary schedule.
We could use these coaches on our Sunday hockey, I think. Representative Winkler, what do you think?
You could, Mr. Chair.
Wow. Ouch. Representative Pepper.
Wow.
Might have to visit up. I have to visit the boards.
Representative Winkler, that was cruel.
That's not help me.
Yale Carnegie 101. Yale Carnegie.
Representative
Pepper didn't go.
Thank you. Thanks for the answer, Mr. Dale. I guess I'm a little frustrated with the coaching provisions, but that's a universal problem. Could you talk a little bit about provision 6? It may be the administrators may be guaranteed a probationary faculty position in the event the administrative position is involuntarily ended. Can you talk a little bit about why this is necessary and what the cost might be on this? Is there been a problem, or what are we looking at there?
Mr. Dale or Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, if I might for just a moment jump back to your last question. I failed to mention that there are 3 Division I coaches in the state university system, and those are the coaches that are commanding the salaries that are above the top of our salary schedule. So that really the only people that we would expect to receive the full amount of that salary supplement would be the 3 Division I hockey coaches. Jumping to paragraph 6 in Mr. Hubinger's summary, the provision that we added provides for a guarantee of a probationary appointment for a new administrator or a current administrator at the time of hire or any time thereafter in the event that the administrator's appointment is involuntarily ended. It has been a significant issue with our state universities, recruiting in particular deans and academic vice presidents. We have an extremely high turnover rate, and if I explain what happens, you can understand why it is such an issue in this particular about job security and why this particular provision we expect will be helpful. if you are to recruit an external candidate to one of our dean's positions or a vice president position within the state universities, the likelihood is that candidate is coming from another university at which they hold faculty tenure. In other words, they have complete job security in the event that at that university, in the event that somebody doesn't like the way they're performing their job, they have the guarantees of protection of tenure. In order for MISU to try to attract or retain to attract that type of candidate, it's very difficult. If you have no offer of job security whatsoever, other than you'll get 90 days notice before we send you packing, the likelihood is if job security is an important issue for that candidate, they're simply not going to come to your institution. And so MISU was finding it very hard to recruit and attract outstanding candidates for academic administrative positions. We have, in fact, since I was employed, began employment with MISU in October of 1996, MISU has been pursuing language that would allow a path to tenure for academic administrators that were recruited from the outside in order to provide that level of job security in the event that their performance became unpopular, and in order to be able to attract these candidates who had job security at their current state universities or their current private universities even. So that's why we were very happy that we were able to find a way to set the language, to draft language that the parties could finally agree on and provide this level of recruitment tool for our administrators.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. And I have several questions, so if any other member wants to jump in, please let me know. I generally, there aren't a lot of questions, so it's okay. I'll continue. Thank you, Mr. Dale. It's not specific here about what the guaranteed probationary faculty period would be. Is there a specific time amount? And then back to the other question that you clarified on the three Division I coaches. I just want to clarify, does that mean only those three coaches are eligible for the $85,000? Or are all the coaches eligible but just not for the amount? Could you clarify that? And if you, I think in an earlier statement you said you didn't have the detail of it, and if you don't have the detail, it'd be great to get it at a later date for when we hear this again.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I don't have the total number of coaches in the system, so I can't tell you that. I would expect that only the three Division I coaches would get the full $85,000 salary supplement, which would probably be necessary to make their salaries competitive for Division I hockey programs. Other coaches, I would anticipate, particularly of the classic revenue sports, even though they're probably not revenue generating for our state universities, would probably get a salary supplement because those folks tend to be working year-round, and the salary supplement will be an effective way of addressing those activities, work that they do outside the normal appointment year, and it'll be an effective way to compensate them and any questions about whether they have been adequately compensated. I would not expect it to involve the full $85,000. I would expect it would be considerably less. Jumping now to your question regarding the guaranteed probationary appointment, the probationary period that would be guaranteed would be required 5 years, and with no early application for tenure by the former administrator who had gone to the faculty unit. So they would go through a full probationary period and would be engaged in the normal, fairly rigorous professional development and evaluation process that we have built into the agreement, and would be evaluated for tenure. Just like any other faculty member. It's not a guarantee of tenure, it's a path to tenure. And our goal here is to address the concerns both of the faculty that they're not going to have a stranger to their departments forced on them, and at the same time address the concerns of the administration that they have to find a way to provide a certain level of job security in order to attract those candidates who have job security at their current universities.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Lilly and Mr. Dale. You said the probationary period, the guaranteed probationary period is 5 years. So just as an example, so if they were on the job for 6 months and it was determined that they weren't doing the job that they were hired to do, and they weren't doing it sufficiently, then are you saying that they would still be guaranteed 5 years of salary? Would they, what would happen? Would they move into a different position? How would, if you could just run me through how exactly that would work, and then also if you have any estimated cost on what this could mean for the bottom line.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, it does not mean that if they were not performing that they would have 5 years of employment. There are non-renewal provisions in our agreement for probationary faculty members, and those provisions would apply to these faculty members just like any other probationary faculty members. It isn't a common occurrence, but it does happen. So they're not, it's a guaranteed appointment. It's not guaranteed appointment for 5 years. When I said that it has to run for 5 years, what I meant was is that currently, most probationary faculty members can apply for tenure early if they want to. It doesn't happen often, but it happens sometimes. These particular faculty members, because they had come from through this administrative position and through this particular provision in the agreement, would be required to serve out the full 5-year probationary period before they could be considered for tenure. But the probationary appointment could be ended through the means provided in the agreement, just as with other probationary faculty members. And I'm afraid I think I've forgotten the second part of your question.
The cost.
We don't have an estimated cost for this. We're not really sure. But I would expect that it would not be very high. And, in fact, the fact of the matter is that most faculty members are not earning quite as much as the administrators are currently.
But Mr. Dale, you said you had a number there? Did you say right here?
Mr. Carlson?
Yes.
Or Mr. Carlson, sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. No, actually, I think the number would go down, is that they leave the administrator ranks and go back to faculty. Generally speaking, depending on the role assignment, that salary would drop. So it would actually be a savings in that regard.
Representative Pepin.
Thanks, Representative Lilly. Well, until you hired somebody new, but... Anyway, let's move on to number 7. The Hubinger report just says that it adds clarifications and makes numerous technical modifications to the layoff provisions that apply in the event of retrenchment of faculty. If you could provide more detail on exactly what that means, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I can provide quite a bit of detail, and I'm not sure exactly how much you'd like, but I can walk through it if you'd like. But let me just say, let me try to generalize and see if that addresses your concerns. There were areas of confusion with the layoff article, the retrenchment article, and specifically those areas had to do with the preferential reemployment rights that faculty members who were laid off, were tenured and laid off, would have to seek a position that was in one of the designated academic areas. And those areas of confusion were clarified, we believe, in a manner that will, the manner that was satisfactory to the employer, and that I believe that the union found was inconsistent with their prior interpretation of the agreement, but nonetheless they were willing to accede to, given the overall package in this particular round of negotiations. Additionally, there were some other areas of clarification centering around catastrophic retrenchments, which has never occurred in our system, but nonetheless we provided clarification about the consequences. We actually eliminated the reference because it has never occurred, and we clarified how recall works, and that would be faculty member obtaining the position from which they had been laid off at the same university. Finally, there is a feature to the retrenchment article that was negotiated in prior to my joining Minsky, which essentially affords a three-year notice period for a faculty with 20 years of service. There was confusion around the 20 years of service, and that was clarified to make sure that it was understood that it's 20 years of full-time equivalent service, and so that faculty members couldn't, in theory, be getting negating this benefit before they had reached 20 years of seniority, in effect. And finally, there was some harmonizing of notice dates because some faculty groups were getting notices before others, and so we were able to harmonize the notice dates and just provide a single, have a single notice date by which the retrenchment notices would be provided. Other changes were more or less editing or formatting, but they're fairly extensive to try to make the article more readable for the average faculty member so that they would understand what their rights were and what management's rights were. And if you'd like me to go into greater detail on that, I can, but I don't know if it'll be.
That's interesting. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Lillian. Mr. Dale, thank you so much for that. I won't ask you to go into more detail now, but if there is something that I could read that would enlighten me further, I'd really appreciate the opportunity to do that. I'm sure we'll hear this on the House floor in January or February, so if you could get that information, that would be really helpful so I could see what that's all about in case anybody in my caucus asks what that is. I can answer it for them. And then I just kind of have a general question about continuing provisions. I see that, you know, looks like there are several things that are continuing, the faculty reaching 10, 20, and 30 years of service continue to receive a career step equal to 2 steps. Faculty who are promoted continue to receive 2-step increases. The University Scholars Program, which can award sums up to $6,000, is continued here. There's continue funding for professional study at $1,300 for each faculty member. There's a continuation of 30 credits per year in free tuition or tuition waiver for a faculty and their spouses or their kids, which I think would be about probably an entire year. I think probably the average is maybe 15 or so credits a semester. And then I see that it's continued the phased retirement that someone can work maybe a third of the time and receive insurance and retirement benefits. Sabbatical program continues, continued the separation agreement. And I'm just wondering, one of the concerns that I just sort of have overall when looking at these is that it doesn't, I see from 8 to 18, so at least 10 things are continuing, but I don't see anything sort of going away. It just keeps adding on. And I'm wondering if any of those things are ever even talked about. Do you go and look at any of these things and say, gee, you know, the state isn't taking in as much money. Maybe we need to look at to see if these still match the economy. Are those ever taken into consideration, or is it just, yep, we've had this in the past, we're just going to rubber stamp it and move forward? Because my concern is that every year we put in, you know, a little tweak here and there, and then, you know, and then you can never kind of renegotiate that. And I'm just wondering what the, you know, what kind of the strategy is there, if that's been discussed. Either of you two.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. Well, it is the case that it is, as a management advocate, it is difficult to negotiate the removal of current benefits for employees. Typically, the match up of revenue to the set of compensation and benefits, if there's a disparity or if there's a problem and shortfall of funding, it's reflected in the compensation increases as opposed to the removal of benefits. But it probably does happen from time to time that benefits are removed. These benefits, as you've pointed out, were not removed. I would have to say that I think most of the benefits are fairly typical of what you will find in higher education environments. And I think in this particular case, the revenues that were available to the employer are reflected in the increases, which are not at all overly generous, and I think are fairly conservative given the increases that have been negotiated in state service.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. And Mr. Carlson, just out of curiosity, I did meet with someone on your staff briefly, and I understand that the contract we're going to talk about next, I was kind of figuring out how they're funded. Is it all from the state budget? Is it from the state budget and tuition, how it's funded? And I think that he'd mentioned that the administrator plan is funded here, And I'm wondering if the interfaculty organization contract, if you could just talk about how that's funded. Is it funded strictly from the state appropriation? Is it with tuition? What, if you could just run me through that. I don't know if I've ever had that information.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the funding, it's approximately right now, it's, and I'm not the chief financial officer, so bear with me here, about 60 and 40. 60% is tuition and 40% is state appropriation. And that would come across all units that, that okay. we serve.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any other questions, or do you want to go to...
Thank you. No, just a kind of overall comment, and it looks like you've temporarily frozen tuition, but I think, you know, I mean, one of the things that I that's really important to me when you look at these contracts, you know, you negotiate the contracts, is that, you know, we're paying for this through taxpayer dollars and then also for tuition increases, and we hear so often and the campaigns talk so often about tuition increases. This is part of it, and why we want to make sure that that, you know, staff is paid adequately and administrators are paid adequately. It's just I sometimes feel like the overall picture is kind of one-sided and not taken into consideration. So I appreciate the work you've done, and I'll have some more questions on the other plan.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, are you?
Yes. With the chair's permission, I'll turn to the personnel plan for Minsky administrators.
As excuse me, Mr. Carlson, yes. I'm going to interrupt. We have a... I was wondering if someone's willing to... I thought they were together. Is anybody interested in moving SER 1?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move SER 1, and I would request a roll call.
Representative Hillstrom's... moved SER 1, asked for a roll call. I'm sorry, I thought they were together. I misunderstood. So is there any further questions on SER 1? And, again, we have a roll call. Mr. Hubinger, would you call a roll?
Representative Lilly?
Aye.
Representative Hillstrom?
Aye.
Representative Pepin?
Nope.
Representative Winkler?
Aye.
Senator Eaton?
Aye.
Senator Metzen?
Aye.
Senator Saxog?
Yes.
SER 1's approved 6-1. Thank you. I'm sorry for my misunderstanding on that. I thought both contracts were on the same item. Mr. Carlson, can you proceed on the administrator's plan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As of fiscal year 2013,
Mr. Carlson, can I interrupt for a second? I just want to say thank you for the, you know, I know we focused on the coaches and, you know, and those are legitimate questions and all that, but, you know, our faculty in our college system just plays such a vital role for our, you know, you really notice it when you're out door knocking and the retooling of our future of a state and being competitive. So these professors do a great job and, are really vital to the strength of Minnesota. But thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, thank you for those comments. We're very proud indeed of our faculty, and we wouldn't be in the position we are in without them. So thank you very much for that comment. Turning to the personal plan for Minsky administrators, as of fiscal year 2013, the base year for comparison purposes, there are approximately 550 employees covered by the administrator's plan, or about 3% of our workforce. The Minsky Board of Trustees approved the tentative agreement at a special meeting called for the purpose of reviewing the tentative agreements between the Minsky Board and MSCF and MUSAP contracts on July 23, 2014. As indicated on the settlement cost sheet distributed by Mr. Hubinger's summary, the cost to the employer of the administrative plan is on the low end of the spectrum of settlements reached between MMB and the state's classified units. So for the economics, for fiscal year 2014, a merit pool of 2.5% of base salaries, health and dental insurance changes as established by MMB for state managers. For fiscal year 15, again, a merit pool of 2.5% of base salaries, health and dental insurance changes as established by MMB for state manager. and for the compensation of the HRA, the health reimbursement account, increase HRA contribution from $600 to $800 per year, matching the IFO's contribution. Non-compensation language changes include the chancellor's contract, which is a provision now that requires the full board approval for an employment contract with the chancellor. Vacation leave. We've clarified leave transfer language for temporary administrative appointments. This clarification modifies the language of new administrators so that the 34-day cap will not limit the transfer vacation, but will apply to the administrator's balance each year. Unpaid leave. Authorize unpaid leave of absence from current administrative position for up to 1 year to facilitate acceptance of a new administrative position in the system. We've also recalibrate the severance formula to avoid excessive severance payments for our most highly compensated administrators. As a recruitment and retention tool, we've added a new student loan reimbursement stipend capped at $2,500 a year, and that is for administrators only. That does not extend to any family member. The relocation expenses section has been revised to allow relocation expenses for individuals reemployed after a break in service of 1 year or greater. The tuition waiver section has been revised to allow the chancellor or the vice chancellor of human resources to elect the provision from the MAPE supplement agreement to apply to system office administrators. There is no substantive enhancement in this benefit. Salary administration. A provision has been added to the salary administration section that allows for placement of and salary setting for athletic directors or assistant athletic directors with head coaching responsibilities for Division I sports. Mr. Chair, I stand for questions at this time on the MNSCU personnel plan for administrators.
Any questions? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Either Mr. Carlson or Mr. Dale, I'm wondering, I have an old personnel plan for administrators with their costs, and I'm wondering if there's a new one since then. This is for 2013 to 2015, if this is the most current.
It is.
Mr. Dale or Mr. Carlson? Looks like you're both leaning in.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the 2013-2015 agreement, we provided a legislatively marked version of that agreement to the committee, and I'm guessing that's what you're looking at, so that would be what we're proposing would be the new agreement. It's legislatively marked with the underlined language being the new language and the strikeout provision, strikeouts indicating the language that would be deleted.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Lilly and gentlemen. Can you talk a little bit about the current salary of the chancellor? I know I see a range here. I don't think he's maxed out yet, but can you talk a little bit about the salary and then I know there's some fringe benefits. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how presidents and vice chancellors fit in there?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the range for the chancellor is effectively in this contract, in this plan. I don't have the current chancellor's contract with me. The chancellor's contract is negotiated within the confines, with the constraints of the personnel plan between the board and the chancellor. It is not something that I, as a subordinate, am involved with except to make sure that the pay is processed appropriately. I can tell you that the chancellor's salary falls within the range of the plan's provisions.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Lilly and Mr. Carlson. It looks like I see it now on Mr. Hubinger's sheet. It says that the salary is $387,000, and that looks like it's just shortly where it's pushing up against the $390,000 max. So what happens when we come here 2 years? Will we change the maximum and minimum? We just bump that up by another $100,000, or how does that process work?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, I don't envision bringing a salary schedule enhancement forward, but if we were to do that, the board would have to approve it, and then it would come to this committee or the full legislature for approval. So you would have an opportunity at that point. But I personally do not see that as forthcoming.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Lilly, Mr. Carlson. And could you talk a little bit about the fringe benefits as well? Specifically, I have some information here on the per-month housing, transportation, communication, travel, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not really clear if that's for just the chancellor, if it's for all of the administrators, or who that's for. I have on my information here, it's about $43,000 a year for housing allowance, $15,000 for transportation, close to $4,000 for communications, $7,200 for transportation, et cetera, et cetera. Who is that accurate, and who qualifies for that?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you are correct. You are looking at the chancellor's compensation package as negotiated between the board and the chancellor. Those apply only to the chancellor.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. So if I add up all the fringe benefits for the chancellor, it looks like it's about $101,000. Tell me if I'm wrong on that. And then can you talk to me a little bit about what would happen if the contract were terminated? What would be the pay?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I'm at a loss, and I don't have the contract, the chancellor's contract in front of me, but there is a provision that would allow for a certain amount to be paid out in the event the chancellor is terminated without cause. Certainly, if it's for cause, some sort of fraudulent activity or whatever, there is no payout. But I don't have the specific numbers of that contract. Oh, we've got a contract. Somebody actually. All right. If you'll give me one moment here, I will find a termination clause. The termination clause, without cause, would allow a 12-month base salary termination payout.
Say that again, please.
The contract negotiated between the Board of Trustees and the Chancellor allows for a 12-month payout if it's for without cause. In other words, they just want him to go away. If it's for cause, there is no payout.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Carlson, so that would be, if you added up the fringe benefits, if this were to happen, it would could be close to $300,000 that students and taxpayers were on the hook for, it looks like. I thought I read in here, and I can't seem to find it, there's an indemnification clause, and I can't figure out where I saw it at. Am I incorrect in that? Could you run me through it?
Mr. Carlson or Mr. Dale?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, all state employees are indemnified for actions taken against them in the line of their work. I don't know anything other than that you'll be referring to.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. I could have sworn I saw a specific clause on it, and I'll continue to look for it. There's so many questions I have here. I don't think I have any other. I do have. Just a comment. I want to make sure I'm right here. I did some research on, I should say I had some staff do some research on some Minnesota tuition and fee trends. And I do have a little bit of a concern. It looks like, I could hand this to you later, but I don't think it's handed out. And it looks like Minsky was done better than the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, but the cost of tuition has increased by 47% since 2004-2005, according to the trend information that I have here. And you know, I hear from students all the time, university students, about the cost of tuition. And, of course, if 40% of, or no, 60% is, of these contracts are through tuition, I do have some just sort of overall concerns about students and what they can expect for rising tuition. And I'm wondering what's the plan going forward for tuition. I have a chart that talks about averages, and it looks like it's been over time around 4% a year through the system. If you average it out, it's 4, 3.8, a lot of fours, a lot of high threes, average of 3.7. And just kind of where are we looking at going forward? What can I tell my I tell my constituents that are students or that have students going to Minsky?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, you have every reason to be concerned about tuition. We all are. It's in fact, we're having a board meeting. It started yesterday. It continues on today. It is always a major discussion topic for the Board of Trustees. How can they continue to serve students in the best possible way while keeping costs down? We are the lowest. The Chief Financial Officer showed some charts of just how in Minnesota we are the lowest cost provider of outstanding education in the state by a significant margin. That doesn't mean that we don't take very seriously the rise in tuition that has occurred over the years. You were correct. There is a freeze presently. The board is contemplating how to deal with that going forward. I know there's been a lot of talk about with the University of Minnesota continuing a freeze. I can't speak to where the board will end up in that regard, but I know that holding down tuition costs is paramount to the board, to the chancellor, to the entire system, and that is a continuing topic for us as we look for ways to reduce costs.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, I appreciate that. I know tuition is a huge concern, and I want to do my part to keep tuition low, and so whatever I can do to encourage the system to do that as well, I will. Would appreciate you passing that on. I do have actually thought of one more question. I think this is a new term in the contract. What is the purpose of the $5,000 for placement service if the chancellor is terminated? Looks like it's a new little perk. So presumably to go to a headhunter, we're going to give them $5,000 for replacement services. And again, my overall concern is that once you've got it in the package, it's there into perpetuity, and it's an additional cost. And was that something that the chancellor pushed for, or why is that there?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, that is correct. It is correct that it would be to allow the current chancellor an opportunity to procure professional services to help him transition to another position. But it is not in perpetuity. It is this contract, like all contracts, are negotiated individually, and I would not necessarily expect this to be in a future contract. It was new this time. I suspect it was at the chancellor's request that be included, and it would have been part of the negotiation process that, again, I was not privy to. It was between the board and the chancellor. But each contract would stand on its own, like an individual contract.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Pepin.
Oh, thank you, Chair Lilly. Mr. Carlson, I did find the it was in the Chancellor's Employment Agreement that I had a copy of. I don't know if everybody else has a copy of it, but I had a little research done where I had the Chancellor's Employment Agreement. Well, anyway, it's on page 6, line 10, the indemnification and representation. The Chancellor shall be eligible for indemnification and representation in accordance with Minnesota statute number 3.736, and then that's the state will pay compensation. The statute, the state will pay compensation for injury or loss. So is that for if under 9, where it says the exception to salary continuation and the just cause language, would that just be so when would the state be on the hook if the chancellor did something wrong? Would it be if he, you know, if he embezzled money, or exactly how would that work, or when would that be applicable?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, this would be what is offered to all state employees in the line of work. It's not uncommon for people in senior positions to be named in a lawsuit or have a claim against them, and it's in the line of their duties that they would be indemnified. However, if it was for things, as you suggest, a fraud or so forth, no, they would not be indemnified for any unlawful act, only for lawful activity in the course of their work.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So only for if they're fired for, or if only they fall under this just cause language. There's several things that talk about just cause. So if they, so you're saying if they embezzled money from the school, it's just if they're in a lawsuit that doesn't involve any personal crime on their part, that's when they'd be indemnified?
I'm getting nods, but just
yes.
Say.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are separate issues that you're talking about, but to your latter point, if there were something illegal, some illegal activity, he would not be indemnified and would be actually prosecuted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, I have a quick question. What's going on in Winona? I'm following the news, and there's some, like there was a vote taken against Rosenstone, a no-confidence vote. What exactly is going on, and what does that mean to his leadership and for us?
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, and I, like you, have gotten this from the news media, this is the Faculty Senate, which is a group of about 28, as I understand it, members at Winona that have filed a vote of no confidence against the chancellor. And we do have the IFO president with us here today, but as I understand it, this is not an IFO or faculty-wide initiative, but a local concern. And I think, if I might offer my opinion, what the chancellor is trying to do is move the organization forward, and he's taking some very bold and some big steps in that regard. Change is hard. And the faculty and all employee groups, I've been involved in all sorts of employee groups where we've done large change initiatives, and there is always resistance to change. That is just part of us as being human. And I suspect that that's what this is about. Charting the Future is a bold endeavor to move Minsku forward, and I suspect that there is some resistance as a result of those bold initiatives that the board, as well as the chancellor, have taken. That's all about all I know, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Carlson, what is the actual cost of the 3.5% this biennium and the 5% next biennium? What's the dollar amount?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I'm sorry. Are you asking about the IFO agreement increases?
No, I'm sorry. We've already,
okay,
Mr. Dale, we've
plan?
Covered that. Yeah, the administrator's plan. And the settlement cost sheet, it says it's a 3.5% increase this biennium that adds 5% to the base next biennium.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, the financial reporting was provided to the committee, and it indicates that in terms of when calculating the turnover savings, that the total cost, new costs associated with the changes in the administrative plan will be approximately $6 million on a $173 million base. So that would be the 3.5% within the biennium and 5% going forward total base rate increase. That's the way I think of your biennium over biennium increase. So it's approximately $6 million, which consists of $4.5 million in salaries and $1.5 million of related benefit cost increase.
Mr. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Dale, I'm sorry. So the $6 million, is that inclusive of both this biennium and the next? That's this.
That is this biennium.
And so, Mr. Dale, what is the 5% for the next biennium base?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, you have me somewhat at a disadvantage of doing math quickly, but it would be approximately...
I'm not going to score it either, so...
It would be approximately a 5% on the $173 million base is what you would experience in the next biennium. So that would be $5 million plus, I guess, $3.5 million, approximately $8.5 million in the next biennium is what you might expect the increase to be.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Let's see. I had a follow-up question on... yes, it is. The personnel plan, this covers 547 FTEs, and Minsky has 54 campuses, so that's approximately 10 employees per campus, but I imagine a number of those are at the central office. So I don't know which of you could answer, but I wonder if you could give a breakdown of how many of these 547 are at Minsky's central office versus the campuses.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, good question. The system office has approximately, 35 administrators. The rest are distributed throughout the system.
Representative Winkler. And
Mr. Carlson, so the 30 to 35 administrators would all be covered under this plan?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, that is correct.
Okay.
Representative Winkler.
It sounds like Senator Metzen has a...
Senator Metzen?
Somebody's nodding in the audience or a disapproval of that 35 numbers. So that's what you think it is.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Carlson.
Senator Metzen, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but we're talking about just the administrators, not the total number of people that work in the system office. We have a lot of IT people, so they're MAPE employees. We have approximately 375 employees total in the system office. That would include AFSCME, MAPE, MMA, managerial, a lot of confidential and commissioner's plan employees that work in my office, for instance, in the human resources area. So that's off the top of my head. I could get a more accurate number of administrators. But just on terms of administrators, that's approximately.
Mr. Chair, just Senator the administrators in this group is about 35 years.
Correct.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, and to either of the testifiers, I know that in the down years of this of our budgets and in the recession, the faculty ended up with a salary freeze. Did the administrators covered by this plan also have their salaries frozen historically?
Mr. Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, they did indeed for 3 years, the same 3 years as the faculty units took a freeze, so did the administrators.
Okay. And then final question, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Winkler.
Mr. Carlson, other provisions, number 9, it says the chancellor has authority to set the salaries of presidents and vice chancellors anywhere within their salary ranges. Is that new language? Is that a new authority given the chancellor?
No.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, that is not new language. That's okay. Always been there.
Thank you.
Senator Metzen, did you have a...
No, I just, Mr. Chairman, I was going to piggyback on Representative Winkler's that during the recession, everybody had to kind of pitch in, including the administrators and all the employees at, for 3 whole years there. So you helped the state and all of us get out of a jam, so to speak, and here we are today. So personally, I think it's time to start upping the ante just a little bit because you did take that 3-year hiatus, so to speak, and help solve the state problems.
Mr. Carlson?
Okay.
Representative Pepin. How am I doing? I didn't say anything about rubber stamping or nothing.
No. Somehow tend to feel it and it results the same, but I appreciate you not saying that. Just on Senator.
Representative Pepin, I do enjoy your questions.
Thank you.
I do.
I think it's interesting.
I'm not sure if Senator Metzen enjoys my questions, but
oh, I do too.
But, but I'm piggybacking on Senator Metzen's comment. What is the for this this group, this personnel plan for the Minsku administrators? What is the average salary for these administrators? I know there's different jobs with those. Vice chancellors and et cetera, but just so we know exactly how much of the pain they felt the last whenever they took a freeze, what is the average?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the average salary for an administrator, if you include, and I need to, I'll go, the average salary is $111,000. Now that includes the 40 or so contract holders, which are the presidents, vice chancellors, and the chancellor. If you call that out, it drops it significantly. So a dean or a vice president, if you call that out, it'd be in the $90,000 range.
Representative Pat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Painful indeed. I guess that's all for my questions.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxon.
I move the contract under SER2.
Mr. Chair.
There's been a motion and then by Senator Saxon, discussion, Representative Pepin.
Can we do a roll call as well? Representative Kirlstrom seemed to have missed it, so I wanted to make sure we got it.
Roll call has been requested. Any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say, we're doing roll call. Mr. Hubinger, thank you.
Whoa. Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Pepin.
No.
Representative Winkler.
Pass.
Senator Eaton.
Aye.
Senator Metzen.
Aye.
Senator Saxog.
Yes.
No, I vote no.
Contracts are approved 5-2. With that, I'd like to thank the staff. Sally does a great job, and Mr. Hubinger, you do a wonderful job on these reports, and thank you for all that. And Mr. Carlson and Mr. Dale, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it very much.
With that, we're adjourned.